The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our blind and print-impaired listening audience. That program is the Indie Week, the Independent, the weekly broadcast from NC Reading Service. I'm John Federson, back with you after 2 weeks of the studio being closed on these holidays, Christmas and New Year's Day. And so I've got a little bit of a backlog to read of some stories that were held over, so we say. And I think I'd better get to it now. We'll begin with the RDU1 Amazon warehouse in Garner. The workers there have filed for a union election with the National Labor Relations Board last week. This was, by the way, an article written just on New Year's Eve. Seeking to become the second unionized Amazon facility in the entire United States, this filing on December 23rd followed a three-year organizing campaign by Carolina Amazonians for Solidarity and Empowerment, or CAUSE. CAUSE ramped up efforts this fall with a push to collect union authorization cards. At least 30% of current RDU1 workers must have signed cards to trigger this union election. While Amazon keeps the headcount of RDU1 under wraps, estimates range from 2,000 to 6,000 workers. Organizers say they believe they've collected well beyond the number of signatures needed. NLRB will now review Amazon's employee list against these cards to verify whether an election can proceed, and the process typically takes several months. "Nothing moves without us," said Mary Hill, an RDU worker and co-founder of CAUSE, said on December 23rd, "We're going to win the election. It's time." In an email to Indy, Amazon spokesperson Eileen Hands wrote that Amazon is, quote, very skeptical that CAUSE, quote, has a sufficient number of legitimate signatures to support a petition for election. The fact is, Amazon already offers what many unions are requesting: safe, inclusive workplaces, competitive pay, industry-leading benefits, including health care on day one, prepaid college tuition and a 401k with company match, opportunities for career growth, and more. The election filing comes amid mounting tensions at RDU1. Earlier this month, Amazon fired CAUSE President Ryan Brown, citing violations of the company's anti-harassment policy, a move that organizers view as a retaliation for union activities. Days later, Garner police arrested three CAUSE supporters who were collecting union cards outside the warehouse during a shift change. The filing also comes at a moment of heightened labor activity at Amazon facilities nationwide. On December 20th, thousands of Amazon delivery drivers launched a six-day strike during peak holiday shipping week, demanding higher pay and better working conditions. Only one Amazon facility has successfully unionized. That's JFK 8 in Staten Island. Other warehouses have managed to trigger elections, but failed to secure enough votes, struggling against aggressive corporate opposition and challenges posed by Amazon's notoriously high turnover rates. The timeline for this election at RDU1 could face additional uncertainty, given the upcoming presidential transition. During Donald Trump's previous presidency, companies like Amazon had more favorable conditions for challenging union election results. Even after a successful vote, employers can file objections, as Amazon did at JFK 8, where it submitted 25 challenges to the union victory, and at a facility in Bessemer, Alabama, where its objections led to a rerun election and ultimately a failed unionization attempt. With Trump's NLRB potentially more receptive to such challenges, any post-election disputes at RDU1 could face delays or increased scrutiny. Okay, next article written December the 19th about Raleigh, St. Augustine's University property. A Florida-based real estate investment company, 50 Plus One Sports, has signed a contract with St. Augustine's University to lease the entirety of its 105-acre downtown Raleigh property and build a mixed-use development on 55 of those acres. Monty Valry, a managing partner of 50 Plus One Sports, says he expects the development to generate $2 billion for his company and $1 billion for the university over the course of the 99-year lease through a revenue-sharing arrangement. Valry says the development will cost about $700 million. Most of the acreage 50 Plus One plans to build on is empty, but Valry says the company will need to tear down some educational buildings and rebuild them closer to St. Aug's main campus in order to make space for the new development. Although 50 Plus One specializes in developments centered around sports stadiums, Valry says there won't be a stadium component to this project. The company hasn't decided exactly what to build, but Valry predicts it will include, quote, housing, food, and beverage. And there's some notes about 51 Plus One Sports, a small property company based in Coral Gables, Florida. It's not exactly a real estate development firm, an investment firm, or a social equity firm, says Valry, but some sort of fusion of the three. From the outside, the timing of St. Augustine's University and 50 Plus One deal seemed sudden. On November 17th, days before the university published its financial audit, and weeks before an important accreditation hearing, it signed a letter of intent with 50 Plus One. According to the financial audit, the letter laid out the initial $70 million payment and revenue-sharing plan, but did not specify how much land SAU would be leasing or what it planned to build. Valry says the process of meeting with SAU and discussing a partnership began a month earlier. He heard about the financial challenges in October and learned that the school sat on prime real estate near downtown. He says, I was shocked that a university could have that much property in city limits close to downtown, so this is an amazing opportunity, one that I have not seen in a lot of places. Despite SAU's recent struggles with debt and accusations of financial mismanagement, Valry says school leaders have been great partners so far. We're not in the business of owning land, he says. We're in the business of doing land leases. Our objective is for SAU to own its land at the end of the day. For the first 10 years of this agreement, 50 Plus One will take home 65% of the revenue from the development, and SAU will get the other 35%. For years 11 through 99, the revenue split will adjust to be 60-40. The university did not respond to a request for comment, but published a press statement calling the land lease deal a significant milestone to our journey towards financial stability, community engagement, and sustainability. Our next several articles, few anyway, from the Durham School System and Durham School Board. And the first one, the board has approved walk zones near 21 elementary schools in Durham. This article written 3 days before Christmas on the 22nd of December. Durham schools will stop providing bus service within 1 mile of these 21 elementary schools and will instead require most parents with living within those family responsibility zones to transport their children to school, decided the school board. It also voted to continue planning, quote, express bus stops for students attending three schools, Durham School of the Arts, Rogers Haar Middle School, and the School for Creative Studies. Both of these steps aimed to resolve an ongoing bus driver shortage that has afflicted the district since August. Prior to that vote, bus drivers urged the board to give them a voice at the table. DPS bus driver said Larry Dixon, "We would love to meet with the superintendent. Let us give you a true perspective of what goes on these buses on a day-to-day basis that we have to deal with." Retha Daniel Ruth, who has driven school buses for 31 years, echoed this sentiment. "The solution here is worker voice," she said. "Don't make decisions and then come to us as like a protocol and say, okay, we'll talk to you now, but we've already decided what we're going to do." The board's rotational bus service plan also received mixed reviews. The plan, which took effect at the beginning of December and was recently extended to January the 17th, means the district provides families with only 4 days of bus service coverage instead of five, in an attempt to ensure more consistent routes. Daniel Ruth told the board, "The rotation plan is not working. As you can see, there are a lot of kids that are getting left out." On the other hand, Rebecca McDonald, president parent of a DPS kindergartner, said the approach has helped to reduce absences. She said at Creekside Elementary, the rotational service has immensely helped, reducing the number of students that are absent or staying very, very late. "Our school has been disproportionately impacted, and we really appreciate the equitable approach." Now, the district will return to five-day bus service on January 21st. The family responsibility zones, which were approved in a 6-to-1 vote, mean some families living within a one-mile radius of identified schools will no longer receive bus service starting January 21st. Not all families who live within a one-mile radius of the school fall into the zones, said Matthew Palmer, who is DPS Senior Executive Director of School Planning and Operational Services. Palmer said he and his team have gone in person to look at the streets and sidewalks and worked with school principals to identify where the plan could safely be implemented. The sole no vote came from board member Bettina Umstead, who raised concerns regarding the equity of these zones. "I worry we're shifting who can get to school and who not," she said. Palmer estimates the zones will affect 750 to 800 students, down from the original 1,000 estimate when the zones were first proposed. Now, the express bus stops for students at School of the Arts, Rogers Herr Middle, and the School for Creative Studies were even less popular among board members. The stops would mean that some families at these three magnet schools would need to transport their children to a nearby DPS elementary or middle school that they do not attend. They would then be picked up by the bus for transport to their actual school. However, board members raised concerns that when families applied to the magnet schools, they did so under the presumption of transportation by the district. As Sarah Smith, a working mom of two DPS students, put it during public comment, "Durham parents have ordered their whole lives under the previous busing situation." The first vote to continue to research and implement express stops for secondary magnet schools failed. The board ultimately voted to continue studying the express proposal as a plan to end rotational coverage. That plan will be brought back to the board coming up on January the 9th with more details and a grievance procedure. That amended measure passed 4-2, with the chair, Millicent Rogers, and Umstead voting against. Board member Wendell Tabb was not present for that vote. While the board is focusing on the two new measures, in the short term, Palmer says the long-term focus is on the driver workforce. Currently, 214 candidates are in the hiring pool, though they need to go through background checks, training, and licensing before becoming DPS school bus drivers. Since September, 12 new drivers have joined the staff to make up a workforce of 143 drivers. Now, Palmer explained that a focus on skilled labor is not only about hiring, but also retention. Quote, there's a lot of stress on our drivers. There are a variety of reasons that drivers leave. Some of them are workplace frustration, pay. We can go down the list of what we've heard, and some folks are retiring. Earlier in the evening, driver Larry Dixon spoke about the workplace stress. We as bus drivers and monitors, we've been having a tough time on the school buses, a very tough time. Many of us are definitely considering walking away because of what we have to go through to drive that school bus. We go through a lot of mental, verbal abuse that is just not sustainable for us. On January 9th, the board will revisit this crisis when the public can expect further discussion about the potential for these express bus stops. Now, in a connected article, also published on the 23rd of December, Durham Association of Educators and the district superintendent face a stalemate over a meet and confer policy. We've read some articles about this in past weeks. And here's this one. While many Durham Public School students were finishing up their holiday wishes last week, some of their teachers were busy working on a long list of grievances instead. Micah Tweitmeyer, Riverside High science teacher and Durham Association of Educators president, said at a press conference, the classified paid debacle, admin erasing women workers' years of experience via email, pay cuts, incorrect paychecks, HR dysfunction, an unreasonable new menu for our under-resourced cafeteria staff, social workers without master's pay. And now, of course, the transportation crisis is leaving hundreds of our students stranded every day. The through line connecting all those issues, said Tweitmeyer, is a lack of accountability for management and a lack of respect for workers and our expertise. And the solution, she said, is for the administration to adopt the meet and confer policy that would grant the DAE a union-like seat at the decision-making table. When Dr. Anthony Lewis took over as a district superintendent in August, organizers hoped that he could bridge the previous gap between the union and the school board. As the year comes to an end, though, DAE and Lewis have gotten stuck over just a few simple words that would decide who exactly gets to participate in the meeting and conferring. DAE says the superintendent's version, quote, would not require any other administrators to be present to hear from the union, and would allow the superintendent to select individual, non-administrative, non-union workers to attend the meetings instead. And in a solidarity letter, various labor union leaders from across the country, including the Education Association in Lawrence, Kansas, where Lewis previously served as superintendent, accused Lewis of union busting. The letter states Durham Public Schools administrators are proposing an advisory committee where management would handpick individual workers, including non-union members, to meet with the superintendent. These individual workers could be appointed by the current or future superintendents for any reason. They would have been chosen by management, not elected, via a worker-run democratic organizing structure that would ensure they substantively, represent and are accountable to their fellow workers. Neither the union nor the district have publicly released the text of the draft agreements. Lewis has publicly defended the attempt to include non-union workers in the meet and confer sessions. In the recent holiday email to school staff, he briefly mentioned the ongoing negotiations and emphasized the need for, quote, true collaboration. And at the DPS board meeting, he took issue with the accusations from DAE. Quote, the administration's approach allows for collaboration among a broader group of stakeholders, fostering unity and representation rather than division. including employees who are and who are not members of DAE, ensures that all voices are heard and that the conversation is not dictated by the organization's members. It is not anti-union, or it is not this notion of union busting, but rather pro-worker in the broader sense, ensuring all worker voices are heard and respected. Unquote. While the meet and confer debate has played out locally, Lewis also noted state and federal developments that do not bode well for public schools, pointing to North Carolina's Senate Bill 10, which sends more taxpayer dollars to private schools, and the Trump world threat of abolishing the federal Department of Education. Lewis says we are asking, as we're continuing to craft our legislative priorities, that everyone in this community gets involved in the process of advocating on behalf of public education. Now, in this nearly seven-hour meeting, the board authorized family responsibility zones and approved further consideration of express stops, that article I just read to you. Many bus drivers see the bus crisis as tied to the union's ongoing efforts. What we are facing in transport is just a symptom of a district-wide problem, lack of real worker voice and management accountability, Daniel Ruth said, as I identified him in the previous article. I'm devastated and angry because I care about my kids. I know all kids from all walks of life deserve the best. They need stability and routine. I break my back every morning to make sure I get them to school on time and safely. And it's heartbreaking knowing how many kids are not getting to school every day. Also, a brief excerpt from an article written on the 18th of December last year. I believe I read part of this about the new Durham city manager, but I'll just reread the highlight of it. In a surprise to many, including seemingly some city council members, Deputy City Manager W. Bowman Bo Ferguson was unanimously voted as Durham's next city manager at the Monday night city council meeting. The motion to cast a vote for this appointment was not listed on the meeting agenda. Mayor Leonardo Williams nearly forgot to bring up the motion himself, which came 2.5 hours into the meeting. The city council, legally obligated to have someone in the top administrative role on an interim or permanent basis, needed to vote on a successor for city manager Wanda Page before she officially retires on December 31st. Ferguson will grab the baton on January 1, yesterday. The contract is for 3 years with a starting salary of nearly $300,000 a year. You have big shoes to fill, said Williams. And there are three more pages of Bowman Bo Ferguson, his background, and many of those I've already read, and so the official part is there, that he's now on the job as city manager for the city of Durham. All right, and here's a very lovely article that I did not have a chance to read. It was released on the 18th of December from the Durham Public School teacher who is sending kids home with food for the holidays. Motown classics drifted down Lakewood Elementary's yellow cinder block hallways from the school's gymnasium, alive with shrieks and screams of third graders. In the middle of the gymnasium, 11 cafeteria tables formed a circle on the hardwood floor. Behind them was a ring of pallets stacked high with cans of corn, boxes of Cheerios, and other grocery items. Second grade teacher Turquoise Parker stood in the center of the food packing assembly line, exclaiming, "Welcome to Costco!" as she welcomed friendly faces to the massive food packing event she organizes twice a year. It was a Thursday, and after packing 3,334 bags of food the day before, volunteers still had quite a ways to go until the food raiser reached its goal, 4,800 bags brimming with food supplies. With the public schools closed for the holidays, when this article was written, many children who rely on schools for free breakfast and lunch will miss meals. Parker's event helps fill that gap, providing a bag of groceries for every student in 12 Durham schools. The event's origins go back a decade when Parker learned of one mom's need for food for the upcoming holiday break. One of the parents in my class said, "I don't have anything at all, Miss Parker, like at all. Is there any place I can get food for my kids?" Upon hearing this, Parker, then a third grade teacher at Eastway Elementary, went home and with her husband bought the family bags of food and holiday gifts. She just didn't stop there, though, saying, "I sent a text message out to as many people as I could think of." Well, the food drive expanded each year, and last year, Parker's event raised enough to give every kid at 12 Durham School a bag of groceries for the holidays. Each bag contains a very specific set of items: a can of corn, green beans, baked beans, chicken, and tuna, as well as a jar of peanut butter, a bowl of Kraft macaroni and cheese, a package of ramen, a box of Cheerios, a loaf of bread, and some oatmeal, applesauce, and crackers filled with cheese and peanut butter. The goal is to provide foods that can be easily prepared without access to a full kitchen. Well, Parker, now a teacher at Lakewood Elementary, carefully explained the process to a new volunteer, Becky Hawkins. "Each bag must be packed the same way. This ensures that all the bags fit in the rented U-Hauls parked in the Lakewood Elementary bus pickup line." Hawkins was among the very many welcome extra hands. These volunteers worked steadily for 5 straight days, December 3 through 7, packing, organizing, and dropping off each bag at the 12 schools taking part at the drive. On day 3, the event had a hard stop at 8 p.m., with packing starting again at 8 a.m. the next morning. Adults and schoolchildren surrounded the circle of gray plastic tables around the gymnasium, each volunteer wheeling a cart or stack of plastic containers with 6 paper bags each. One by one, they lapped that circle of supplies, placing each item neatly in a bag. Canned items were stacked at the bottom, Cheerios slotted at the back, and a loaf of bread on top. The Temptations lingered in the air, mixing with the laughter of school children who vied for Parker's attention, crying out her name and bombarding her with questions. Parker called, "Third graders!" called out as the smiling faces jumped, hopped, and slid into a messy circle at hip level around this 5-foot-tall teacher. The 2:15 p.m. bell signaled the end of the school day, and the children assembled into a restless line as Parker sent them on their way out of the gym. She says of her smaller helpers, "I hope they see their part in the world, that you don't have to be out in the front every time. It can be fun helping other people." The noise in the gym died as the children left, leaving 6 adults steadily packing and reorganizing the supply tables. Band-aids covered the volunteers' weathered hands as they filled bag after bag. Hawkins, the newest addition to the group of volunteers, went to Lakewood Elementary 60 years ago. She said, "I remember all this. I remember coming into lunch in the lunch line and doing lunch there and back that way. I feel like I'm home." For Parker, the motivation for this event is simple. "The community is in need," she said. "It's real out here in these streets, and that we need each other." New Year's Eve article, Durham Thrift Store Workers Look for Ways to Help Unhoused Residents Following Break-In. At about 3 a.m., December 22nd, rumors. Co-founder Casey Longyear was awakened by a call from Hoop Boutique's security company. Someone had broken into their Durham location. When she logged into their security camera account, she found that a man had broken through the door of the University Drive thrift store and was wandering around the showroom. Rumors, which Longyear and Marche Weich founded in 2007, has three locations. This was the third time this location had been broken into. By this time, something was different. Longyear says he looked really calm. It didn't look like he was looking for anything. He wasn't wearing a mask. He didn't head for the register or the valuable items. Instead, he laid down under one of the racks as if he was going to sleep, despite the alarm blaring around him. According to the store manager, Molly Schoenert, the police arrived about 10 minutes to arrest him. They pretty much thought, says Schoenert, that, well, he probably wanted that to happen because it was so cold outside. He wanted to be able to go to jail for warmth and probably food. It was 29 degrees that morning, one of the first cold nights of the year. Despite being out of town in Greensboro, Schoenert was on the way. After about an hour of driving, she spoke to police, then got to work cleaning up the broken glass and patching up the door with cardboard. By opening time at noon, Rumors was back up and running, if a little cold. The next day, the shattered door was boarded up, its front decorated by Lydia Williams, one of the employees. According to Schoenert, the glass door can't be replaced until the new year, in case of another break-in over the holiday season, a particularly desperate time for many. $1,500 for a new door is no small expense for the business, but customers' suggestions for a crowdsourcing drive have gone unanswered. Instead, the store's owners hope its fans will shop at the store or buy gift cards for themselves or loved ones. Longyear says, I don't really want to crowdsource for something like this when there's so many other people in need, especially at this time of year. As unfortunate as the incident was for Rumors, owner and manager alike agree that the real misfortune is with that man who sought shelter in the store. Longyear says, I hope Durham can take note of this. It's inspiring me to try to figure out what we can do to show the homeless community that we're there for them. In the past, Rumors has engaged in several charity events, including donations and collaborations with groups like Food Not Bombs and Community Fridges. When Longyear heard about a community member who had lost everything in the house fire or escaped domestic violence, she put store credit in the system for them. At one point, Rumors donated tens of thousands per year, according to Longyear, but this is no longer possible with their current finances. Nothing is set in stone yet, but she says the Rumors team is considering options, like bringing a free rack of jackets downtown to offer the unhoused some much-needed warmth. She only wishes that they had been able to offer the man help before he took such drastic measures. Next time, feel free to call us, or just know that it's a safe space. We would happily have given him a jacket off the store floor, because we have done that in the past, when we've had people come in that are houseless, asking if we had any clothes. I'm happy to do that for people in need, because that's what we are all about. Community. All right, my folder is diminishing rapidly. I have a two-page article written again in December about the Greyhound bus station in downtown, in Raleigh. Excuse me, it's not downtown. That's the point of the article. And then two longer articles, one concerning Southern Season Food Store, which is no longer in business, and finally a running club in the Triangle area. Over a decade ago, local officials envisioned a multimodal transit hub in Raleigh, a downtown focal point where Amtrak, commuter rail, local and regional bus routes would all converge. It would make Raleigh's public transit systems easier and more convenient to use and would catalyze economic development in that surrounding warehouse district. In the words of former Mayor Nancy McFarland, it would be a front door to the city. That vision was partially realized in 2018 with the completion of Raleigh Union Station, the new and expanded train station, and in August of 2025, the Union Station Bus Facility, or RUS, Rus Bus, is slated to open next door this coming August. But while Rus Bus will serve a multitude of Go Triangle and Go Raleigh bus routes, 10 in total, according to Go Triangle, one key piece of the original plan will be absent: regional Greyhound buses. Eric Curry, Go Triangle spokesman, confirmed to Indy that Greyhound will not be a part of the transportation mix at Rus Bus, at least not anytime soon. He wrote in an email that may be something that Go Triangle and transit partners will consider once the facility opens. Greyhound did not respond to multiple requests for comment except to say, quote, "We have no updates to share regarding our operations at the Capitol Boulevard location." Raleigh's Greyhound terminal is currently located at 2210 Capitol Boulevard, more than 3 miles outside the city center. If Union Station is the front door to the city, this is the back door, where people who can't afford to fly, train, or drive into Raleigh arrive by bus and are greeted by an inhospitable landscape of strip malls, concrete, and highway. It wasn't always this way. Greyhound occupied a prime spot in downtown Raleigh from 1969 until 2014, where it sold its property on West Jones Street for $4.5 million to developer Ted Reynolds, who demolished it and built upscale apartments. At the time, local outlets reported the move to Capitol Boulevard was, quote, likely to be temporary. The idea was that Greyhound would relocate to Rus Bus facility once it was built. In the meantime, some city officials tried to argue that the far-flung Capitol Boulevard location was, quote, more convenient for Greyhound riders. Then City Councilor Mary Ann Baldwin told Indy in 2014, their facility was run down. It didn't connect with anything either. Critics of the move viewed it more cynically. Indy wrote at the time, a nexus of poor people, taxi drivers, and bus travelers doesn't quite fit into Raleigh's new creative class vision for itself. Compared to many of its peer cities, as identified by the Chicago Fed and the North Carolina Justice Center, Raleigh's Greyhound Station is uniquely distant from its downtown core and other transit options. In Boston, Atlanta, Austin, and Washington, D.C., the Greyhound Terminal is part of a major multimodal transit hub, making connections easy. In Nashville and Charlotte, Greyhound is a short walk from downtown. Sometime between 2014 and 2024, Greyhound's plans to relocate to Rus Bus went from likely to distant and uncertain. Indy requested public records from City of Raleigh related to Greyhound and Rus Bus in November this last year and has not yet received a response. Curry of Go Triangle told Indy, quote, it's too early for formal conversations with Greyhound about moving to the Rus Bus facility, and there is, quote, no timetable set to begin those talks. Mitchell Silver was Raleigh's planning director in the early 2010s and oversaw some of the early planning of Union Station, and he says, when it was planned, we wanted to be a regional hub. We were in conversation with Greyhound. There were discussions about them relocating. At that time, it was conceived as the primary transit hub for the city, with as many modes as possible. Silver left Raleigh in 2014 to become New York City's Parks Commissioner, so he wasn't involved in the bus facility design or construction phases. He's since returned to Raleigh and was recently elected to the City Council. But during the idea stage, he had been inspired by New York City's transit hub in Midtown Manhattan. This is very similar, he says, to the Port Authority concept in New York, where you had both local and also regional buses. That was where the concept came from. It just made perfect sense. All right, and now I do a four-page article published the end of November last year about an elite running team growing in the Triangle. And it's written by Lauren Wingroth. Alistair and Amy Craig have lived and trained in nearly every running hub in the country over their professional careers. Flagstaff, Arizona, Portland, Oregon, Mammoth Lakes, California, Park City, Utah. Still, they were impressed by the American Tobacco Trail, said Alistair, 44, of this 22-mile footpath spanning from downtown Durham south to Apex. It's the busiest running trail I've ever seen. It's like the Charles River on Boston Marathon weekend every day. The Triangle does not have the credentials of a traditional running hub. It's not at altitude, like Boulder, Colorado, nor does it have a long-running history, like Boston. But it's where the Crags chose to start their Puma, P-U-M-A, elite running team in 2021. With just one athlete and a hunch, that North Carolina might be the next great running destination. So far, their gamble has paid off. The Crags team now boasts 18 athletes representing five countries, including four Olympians. And after several years of quiet successes and slow growth, 2024 has seen Puma elite runners make headlines and break records from the mile to the marathon. The idea that North Carolina could be the home for a professional running team first came to Alistair in 2019, when he was visiting the area. Just in Chapel Hill, he said, there were more trails than we had in Portland. The couple was living in Oregon at the time, where Amy, formerly Hastings, was running with Nike's prestigious Bowerman Track Club, and Alistair was working as the team's assistant coach. Bowerman was a team of top recruits and champions, and Amy, now 40, was a two-time Olympian, considered one of the greatest American marathoners of her generation. But, said Alistair, himself a three-time Olympian representing Ireland, who had ambitions of starting a team of his own, but it felt like we were turning down really good athletes. I was more excited about looking for the needle in the haystack. When Puma tapped Alistair to lead a professional training group, the Crags drove across the country scouting possible locations. Amy, who became a coach when she retired in 2021, says, "We had a list of criteria from our experience as athletes of what would make the ideal training group. We had been at altitude before, which was great, but it was so isolated that people's spouses were going crazy. And sometimes you were battling the elements so much the benefit of that altitude was negligible. Plus, the Crags figured that if they were located somewhere else, they could strategically pick and choose which location might serve them best for seasonal altitude training camps. We don't want to be stuck with one all year," said Amy. The Triangle began to emerge as a place that checked a lot of boxes. Though summers are hot and humid, you can generally run outside year-round. Plus, training in those conditions gives athletes toughness and prepares them for racing in a warmer world, says Alistair. Team member Amon Kemboy, 28, put it, "You race somewhere with less humidity and you feel like you're breathing easy compared to anybody else." There was also the reasonable cost of living, a convenient international airport, the potential for a social life beyond running, and an East Coast location that makes traveling to races easier. The Tobacco Trail was a bonus, with its variety of services, asphalt, dirt, and gravel to choose from, and markers every quarter mile. So was having resources like top-tier medical care of three major universities, each with its own strong running program nearby. Perhaps the biggest bonus, though, was the team could have its pick of local tracks. Alistair said, track access is extremely difficult around the country. You have pro athletes jumping over fences to get to tracks, whereas here we feel spoiled. The team typically does track workouts at either University of North Carolina or Duke, but high schools have also offered their tracks. Amy says, it's so rare. I've been kicked off so many tracks everywhere else I've lived. The team's first year was slow. Puma Elite began with just one athlete, middle-distance runner Taylor Werner, now 26, from the University of Arkansas. After losing many of its recruiting prospects to other brands, Werner has since left the team. They soon added Stanford alum and distance runner Fiona O'Keefe, now 26. O'Keefe had never visited the Triangle before accepting the Craig's offer to join the team, though she's heard good things from her college coach, Chris Miltenberg, who's now the director of track and field and cross country in Chapel Hill. Quote, going pro was a goal of mine, but I don't know how realistic that was. So when an opportunity came up, I was like, I should go for it. Many of the Puma Elite athletes who filled out the team since have similar stories. The Crags offered them a chance, coming off solid but perhaps not exceptional college careers or unrenewed contracts with other brands. Alistair says there's such a small window people's careers are judged on. We're looking for people who may not have hit that window, which could be due to injury or simply not reaching their peak yet. As it turns out, the Craigs are good at spotting potential. Take Dorcas Ewe, 27, a Kenyan 800-meter runner who moved to Chapel Hill after graduating from Campbell University in 2023 without a professional running career on her radar. Alistair spotted her running in Carolina North Forest one day and invited her to train with the team. At first, she struggled to keep up during workouts, but in less than a year, something clicked. Ewoy beat arguably the greatest American 800 runner of all time, Eteng Mu, at the Holloway Pro Classic in Gainesville, Florida, in July. Then in August, she set a state record at the Sir Walter Miler in Raleigh. And in September, she placed second at the New Balance Fifth Avenue Mile, one of the most prestigious road miles in the country, against a stacked field. Then there's Pat Tiernan, 30, who was a two-time Olympian for Australia when Nike decided not to renew his contract. He had a challenging experience at the Tokyo Games in 2021 when he collapsed on the track during the 10,000 and finished last, then subsequently scratched from the 5,000 meters. He joined Puma in 22, and later that year ran the second fastest half marathon ever by an Australian in history. This year he ran the second fastest marathon by an Australian with a speedy 2 hours 7 minutes 45 seconds at Houston Marathon. At the Paris Games, he finished a respectable 24th. But the team's biggest success story is O'Keefe, who shocked the world with a definitive win at the Olympic Marathon Trials in February, running the fastest ever debut marathon by an American woman and the fastest Olympic Trials marathon in history. Her status as a household name in the running world was cemented for a less fortunate reason. A few months later at the Olympics, when she dropped out less than 5 kilometers into the marathon due to an injury, and became the subject of a social media firestorm for not ceding her spot to the alternate. She later clarified that by the time she had any information about her injury, it was too late to swap in the alternate anyway, so she decided to go ahead on the off chance she'd feel better. The Craigs maintain that had O'Keefe been healthy, she would have been a medal contender in Paris. They admit their sky-high expectations for their athletes can sometimes feel delusional. Amy said, there are so many moments where we're like, we think this athlete can do this. Are we being crazy? Is that absolutely insane? But it started happening that the things we saw in training were translating over to races. Still, the move has been an adjustment for the Crags. Alistair says, we were coming from going to the Olympics every cycle with Bowerman to working with kids right out of college. We had to adjust what we thought were successes. That attitude has resulted in a team culture where both Olympic qualifications and wins at local races are celebrated equally. Like when middle-distance runner Jess McGordy, 25, was coming back from a grueling series of injuries earlier this summer, and the Craigs decided to enter her in Raleigh's Sir Walter Running Pop-Up Miles series. Weekly races open to all that culminate in a qualifying race for the Sir Walter Miler. After over a year from the track, she won 3 of the 4 weekly races. McGordy, who's from Addison, New York, says it was a low-stakes environment, but there were people of all ages racing and pushing themselves and cheering. It opened my eyes to the community of runners here. She also qualified for the Sir Walter, a professional race that since 2013 has attracted the best middle-distance runners in the country, from U.S. Olympic 1500 meters bronze medalist Jared Nuguse to American mile record holder Nikki Hiltz. That was as big as going to the Olympics, said Alistair. Tiernan says there were a lot of people who were really excited to see Jess win that qualifying race in Sir Walter. Jess's story looks very different from Fiona, but it had the same meaning to the team, which was really exciting. That McGorty was able to successfully return to the track on her home turf among the greater Triangle running community made it even more special. The athletes don't take this for granted. Mick Stanzovsek, 27, a middle-distance runner who joined Puma Elite after Nike's Eugene-based Oregon Track Club Elite folded in 2022, says, one of the first weeks I was living here, I went to volunteer at a pop-up road mile. I was telling all my friends back west, the running scene is so good here. There were like 400 people around our age just out there doing a road mile on a Thursday night. That wouldn't happen in Eugene, Oregon. O'Keefe said, sometimes you can get a little jaded with doing this day in and day out and it being your job. Seeing people doing it just for the love of it helps me get back in touch with the core reason that that's why I do it too. The solid track and cross-country programs of the region's three major universities also bolster the local running scene. NC State has historically been one of the best women's cross-country programs in the nation, and Chapel Hill is increasingly seen as a contender in both track and cross-country, and is the alma mater of U.S. marathon legend Shalane Flanagan. Duke's teams are often strong as well. Plus, Fleet Feet, one of the largest running stores in the country, is headquartered in Carrboro, offering a litany of community programming through 7 local stores. Alistair says, in the beginning it was like, why North Carolina? You could go anywhere in the world, so why North Carolina? Well, now it's become one of the stops. Runners leave college and they go to either Boston, Oregon, North Carolina, or Altitude. Running may never be central to the Triangle's identity in the way that it is to places like Boulder or Flagstaff, but O'Keefe sees that as a good thing. She said North Carolina has a lot to offer at this stage of your life when you're trying to figure out what your options are. You can be all in on running, but at the same time, there's easy access to other avenues if you want or need to go in any other direction. That's a particularly salient point for O'Keefe, who continues to recover from the injury she sustained in Paris. Quote, I've been fairly narrowly focused on running for the last couple of years, which I don't regret, but I think it would be healthy to figure out ways to feel at home here outside of just running. This summer, Puma Elite gained a recruiting class of young talent that included Alex Mayer, an Oklahoma State University standout. In early October, he made his marathon debut in Chicago, a highly unusual move for a 23-year-old who'd never raced farther than a 10K. It was a success. Going in with a goal of 2 hours 11 minutes, Mayer ran a 2:11:24 and held his own in a field of far more experienced marathoners. "This is the most talented the team has ever been," said Alistair, "and the group is gelling better than we have ever seen." Now the team is preparing for the winter indoor season. A new assistant coach and exciting new recruits are on the radar, as is a Puma Elite house, where team members can hang out, get massages, and physical therapy, and run on treadmills, and where visiting runners and team members based elsewhere could stay. Also on the radar, they hope, getting athletes qualified for the World Indoor Championships this March and the Outdoor World Championships in September. Kim Boy says, "I'm confident about it." He has even bigger aspirations. "I think we'll make that team and go get our medals." Chris Chavez, founder of track and field publication Citius Mag, "After all their success, they're still a bit underrated. That's what's really cool about the team. They're sitting on a secret before the rest of the world finds out. There's plenty of great running ahead for them. I think they'll be making teams and winning titles. It'll be fun to follow along." Even as the team grows in size and renown, you'll still find them most days logging miles on the American Tobacco Trail or in Umstead State Park. Alistair says, "We have a little hidden gem here. Every year I think, how do we make it better? Do we go to altitude? Do we move the group there? But then we come back here after camps and we're like, no, this is great. I wouldn't change this." Well, good for me. I've finished my issue, except for the long article about a Southern Season grocery, which will go into the Save for Later bag. John Feddersen for the North Carolina Reading Service says that this broadcast is available after the initial airing as a podcast. Just find the Independent at the North Carolina Reading Service.org. Thanks very much for listening to Indie Week. So long.